You're listening to 91.9 FM WUOT Knoxville. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and this is Dialogue. As baby boomers across America continue to age, Alzheimer's disease becomes a greater concern for the healthcare system, lawmakers, and the public. It's the sixth leading cause of death among people 65 and older. It's estimated 110,000 Tennesseans already suffer from the effects of Alzheimer's, and that number is projected to increase more than 27% over the next 10 years. On top of all this, there is no cure. This hour, Angela Jones and Sonny Biden of the Alzheimer's Association will join me to discuss what we know and what we don't know about Alzheimer's and its effects here in Tennessee. Join us for Dialogue after this news. Six minutes after the hour on a Wednesday afternoon, I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and welcome to Dialogue from WUOT News. This hour, an important topic, but one that we have not covered, so far as I know, on Dialogue. Some 5.3 million Americans have Alzheimer's disease, have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease this year in 2015. Nearly all of them are the age 65 or over. It is, as I mentioned a few moments ago in our opening, the sixth leading cause of death among people 65 and older in this country. And here in Tennessee, approximately 110,000 people already have Alzheimer's. And that number is only expected to grow as the population ages and as we head into the next decade or so. This hour, we're focusing on what we know and what we don't know about Alzheimer's, and maybe what you need to know about Alzheimer's as it may affect you or someone in your family. Joining us from the Alzheimer's Association based here in Knoxville are Angela Jones and Sonny Biden. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Yes, indeed. We'll start this discussion with what it is that we mean when we say Alzheimer's disease. There are a number of what we call cognitive or neurological impairments that can affect somebody as they age, dementia, mild cognitive impairment, a lot of things. How do we define Alzheimer's?
Well, when someone says Alzheimer's, that's actually a type of dementia. So a lot of times people will talk to us and say, oh, they don't have Alzheimer's, they have just a little touch of dementia. Mm-hmm. And if you'll think of dementia really as an umbrella term, it's like saying I had food today. You had some type of food. So if you have dementia, you have a type of dementia. 60 to 70% of all types of dementia are Alzheimer's, but there are other types of dementia. There's Lewy body dementia, Parkinson's type dementia, frontal temporal dementia. So there are other types of dementia. And mild cognitive impairment is one of the earlier stages of Alzheimer's and perhaps of those other dementias, but I don't know. I'm not as familiar with those.
But Alzheimer's is by far the largest form of dementia.
60 to 70% mm-hmm. of all dementia is Alzheimer's. So when one has a diagnosis of dementia, we would encourage the family members and or the person with that diagnosis to ask more probing questions of the doctor, what type of dementia? And sometimes someone gets that diagnosis and just doesn't ask further questions because who knows? They don't want to ask. They don't want to know. It's still a topic. It's still a disease that has a lot of stigma attached to it. Sometimes the doctor doesn't go into further explanation for lots of different reasons. But if someone has a diagnosis of dementia, it's deeper than that. We really encourage you to go deeper than that and find out what it is.
Well, I'm 30 years old, and I don't mind admitting I have a terrible memory. I can meet somebody at a party, and by the end of the evening, I don't remember who they are. You know, it's one of those things I'm easy to forget, you know, if I have errands or something like that, to forget to pick up the milk or whatever. How do we differentiate between somebody that has these sort of normal, forgot where I put my keys this morning, versus a red flag that might be something more serious? Sonny?
Well, there is a difference between Alzheimer's and normal aging. I mean, I know I've gone to Kroger and walked out of the parking lot and can't even remember where I parked my car.
Right,
That I think that happens to us all, where we've misplaced our keys or forget where we parked. But it's things where, let's say, for the example, the Kroger parking lot, you got there and you walked out to your car and you forgot how to drive. That's a huge difference, a huge sign of some form of dementia.
And what would be a red flag? Is that where I would say I got to talk to a doctor?
Yes. If you have more situations that are occurring like that or similar to that, your first step would be to talk to your general doctor. From there, he would probably ask you a series of questions. We always encourage a family member or a close friend to go with you during these visits because a lot of times they're seeing changes that are going on within their memory and their daily routine, so it's good to kind of have a partner through that.
That the person may not even be aware of themselves.
Yes.
Yeah, and so it helps to have an outside observer. That's really important.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting that you say that. How, if I'm not mistaken, when you're diagnosed with Alzheimer's or the series of tests that are used, there's no single test that can conclusively demonstrate Alzheimer's. It's more of a battery of tests. Isn't that right?
That's right. There are multiple things that one goes through.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first step, as Sunny said, would be to talk to a general practitioner, and then they may refer you to a specialist or a neurologist. But it is a series of tests, talking about behaviors, talking about social interactions. If you have begun to withdraw socially, a lot of times a person will do that because they have forgotten things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just less comfortable to stay in a social circle, and so they begin to withdraw. Perhaps they're depressed. I would be depressed. If I couldn't remember things and participate like I used to, I would get depressed also. So there's a whole host of things that are looked at. But in addition to talking through what's going on, there may be an MRI that's done. The best test at this point that can be done is a PET scan. And the PET scan was actually developed out of a research project that was funded by the Alzheimer's Association. And the PET scan is, we've all seen them on TV or movies where you see the picture of the brain that's lit up in different colors,
mm-hmm.
the yellow, the green, the reds. That will actually show you parts of the brain that are inactive. And so when you look at the PET scan, you can see where the brain has shrunk and where parts of it are inactive. And that will tell you, yes, that is Alzheimer's there, that there's part of the brain that's not active. And then you can compare it over time and see, yes, this part is now inactive, this part is now inactive. And you can tell, you know, step by step, the parts that are shrinking away and know that that's Alzheimer's. So that is a gold standard, but a doctor doesn't go there immediately. It is a battery of tests that one goes through before mm-hmm. one gets to a PET scan.
Sunny mentioned a moment ago something I thought was very interesting, that there's a clear distinction between the normal sort of memory loss that we
mm-hmm.
have when we age and forgetting to put our, you know, keys or whatever, and then having Alzheimer's disease. Very clear distinction between the two. So biologically, what's happening to the brain in somebody that has Alzheimer's? What is different about their brain than is different with mine or yours?
Well, as Angela was describing, basically your brain is shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
There's a buildup of a protein. It's called beta amyloid protein. And it forms plaques on your brain. So think about kind of plaques on the artery to, you know, cause heart disease. This is the same thing. It build up a plaques on your brain. Another protein it's called tau. And if that is called tangles, and tangles form around your brain, basically strangling your brain as well. So that's what you would see on that PET scan as plaques and tangles.
And we all have those proteins in our brain. The reason that Alzheimer's is more prevalent in people who are older is because we've lived longer, and we have the buildup of those proteins more so in our brain. We all have them. We all need them to function in life. But the longer you live, the more you have them, and you've built them up long in your brains. There's some risk factors we can get into later that will increase those, and things you can do to help decrease your risk factors. But the longer you live, the more those proteins you have in your brain, and the more likely you are to have an abnormal buildup that is what defines Alzheimer's.
I was thinking the other day when I was researching this topic in preparation for the show, it sounds a lot like, for our car fans in the audience, gunk that builds up in your engine.
Yes, yes,
and it can
exactly.
impair the function of the engine.
Mm-hmm,
it's the
right.
stuff that builds up that, mm-hmm. that can cause a real problem.
Yeah.
And that is the thing that separates Alzheimer's from just a normal sort of
exactly.
memory loss or an aging
exactly.
process. I understand the Alzheimer's Association has proposed a new set of diagnostic criteria for Alzheimer's, maybe hopefully to catch it a little sooner. First, let's start with, we talked a little bit about how it's currently diagnosed
mm-hmm.
through a series of tests and a PET scan. What would be different about these new ideas that have been proposed by the Alzheimer's Association?
Well, if we can catch it earlier in diagnosis with people, then a couple of things can happen. Number one is that people can begin planning earlier. While there is no effective treatment or cure at this point. There are some medications that can help slow the progression, that can help treat the symptoms. But be clear that there is no cure or treatment for this right now. Almost 5.3 million people have Alzheimer's, and it is a fatal disease. There are no survivors at this point. But if we can catch it earlier, then we can study what's going on with folks earlier. That perhaps can help us in finding a cure or treatment a little earlier. And it also helps in care planning a little sooner. So let's imagine you go to the doctor, you have Alzheimer's, so if we can diagnose it earlier and it's put on your chart, then for some reason you end up in the emergency room. Right now, if it's not on your chart, you end up in the emergency room and they give you instruction on how to care for the wound that you have, and you go home and you end up back in the emergency room a week later, they just think you didn't care for your wound. They don't realize you have Alzheimer's and you couldn't remember what they instructed you to do a week before. And so now if we can have some legislation passed and some earlier diagnostic treatment, earlier diagnostic criteria passed, then it's put in your chart. People know that. They can approach the treatment for you very differently. So it's really important that we have earlier diagnostic and that we chart that in your medical record. It's also important that doctors have the ability to care plan with you. So if we have a mechanism in place where when doctors diagnose you, that they are then paid for care planning with you, because one of the things that happens now is when doctors diagnose someone, there's no, the way the insurance system is set up, there's no time for them to sit and care plan with you, so that often doesn't happen. But if that is set up so that they are paid to do that, which is something we're advocating for with the insurance system on the federal level, then they would have time to sit and do that, and that just changes the game for someone. So those things are really important for someone, to get the best planning possible, that it's put in your medical chart, that you have the ability to plan with your family, to know those things earlier.
Yeah, that's something that we often talk about with other diseases like cancer, talking about an early diagnosis, catching it as soon as possible. It's interesting to see that Alzheimer's is now trying to get to that same stage as far as being in the public's mindset or something like that. Let's talk a little bit, before we go to the break, about how we in the media do talk about Alzheimer's. And I remember about 4 years ago when Pat Summitt was diagnosed with, I believe this is, help me out here, it's early onset. There was some confusion in the press, and depending on which paper or which source you were reading, they would call it something different. It was dementia, it was Alzheimer's, it was early onset, and it was, for the first few weeks, it was clear that we were kind of struggling about how to describe this. It didn't come right out of our minds. What do you see, and Sunny, we could start with you. You do outreach for the Alzheimer's Association.
Right.
Is there something that bugs you about the way we're reporting, or maybe not reporting, what's going on in Alzheimer's?
No, it's kind of what we brought up in the beginning. A lot of people, you know, don't really put Alzheimer's, they don't give it a name. They say, oh, my grandmother's suffering from dementia, or my sister has dementia. Like Angela said, no, Alzheimer's is a type of dementia. And because there is no cure right now, people don't really want to say that I have Alzheimer's because there's no cure. Yes, you can take medications to help slow the symptoms of it, but a lot of people kind of shy away from it. And I don't necessarily think it's anyone's to blame for it. It's just that's how people are, I think. We would love for it to be talked about more, to bring more awareness about it and know that we're here for people as a resource.
And I can direct this to both of you. In the years that you've been involved with this kind of outreach or education with the public, have you noticed that there's been any, have we made any progress in getting people to talk about Alzheimer's, or we still have a lot to go?
It's a disease that I think affects so many people, and because of Pat Summitt, you know, she came forward, you know, I think people are, more awareness is coming towards Alzheimer's. I think I've seen that, Angela has seen that. I think people are talking about it easier.
Yeah, and the early onset is defined as someone who's under the age of
65 and younger is you can have early onset. And what that is, it's kind of a different animal. Yes, it is Alzheimer's, but our biggest predictor of Alzheimer's is age. The older you are, the more likely you are at risk. So that's kind of a different, we're not sure how.
It looks a little genetically different in the body, someone who has early onset. It's more aggressive in how quickly one may decline with early onset. So it is a little different genetically in the body. While it is Alzheimer's, it does look a little different. And people do talk about Alzheimer's a little bit more. I think for nothing else, certainly Pat Summitt has brought more attention to it in our area. But also, it's just affecting so many more people. Mm-hmm. When we do presentations and we say, raise your hand if you know anyone with Alzheimer's, it is rare that someone's hand doesn't go up. Everyone knows someone by now who's been affected by Alzheimer's.
We're going to get into the different diagnoses, the different questions that need to be answered about Alzheimer's, the scientific research that is going on right now. After the break, we're also going to open our phone line. So if you have questions for our panelists about Alzheimer's and its effects on people, on the healthcare system, you can give us a call at 974-5050. Tweet your question at WUOTFM on Twitter, or you can leave a message on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/WUOTFM. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, 20 minutes after the hour, and this is Dialogue from WUOT News. Brandon Hollingsworth back with you on this Wednesday afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us for Dialogue. And, of course, a big thanks to our panelists for being here. We have Angela Jones and Sonny Biden, both from the Alzheimer's Association. And they are here, of course, for the hour to talk to us about Alzheimer's and its effects here in Tennessee. If you have a question, the phone number is 974-5050. I want to begin this portion of the program, Angela, with something we alluded to a little earlier, and I really wanted to ask about this and emphasize this. Alzheimer's is always fatal?
It is. Mm-hmm. What happens is, as Sonny talked about, the beta amyloid and the tau, the two proteins that build up in the brain, there are 7 stages of Alzheimer's. And while the first few stages can almost look like some normal aging, and the first couple of stages, someone can really kind of cover it up sometimes. By the time you start getting into the third stage, there are really some telltale signs that can't be covered anymore. Someone has forgetfulness that's beyond normal aging, things that are affecting their daily behaviors. But what happens by the end stage is that the part of your brain that controls breathing is shut down.
Yeah.
And so that's how someone dies from Alzheimer's. Because we get that question a lot, is how does someone actually die from it? And it affects the part of your brain that affects breathing.
There can also be some other factors. I read in some of my research that mm-hmm. pneumonia can be
indeed
can be a factor there because of the patient's perhaps inability to move, clear their throat,
indeed.
Do the things that we do to avoid pneumonia as healthy functioning adults. Those tend to go away
right.
with somebody in Alzheimer's. Are there other sort of ancillary or tertiary things that could cause death from Alzheimer's that we might not immediately think? Because if you see pneumonia, mm-hmm. if you see pneumonia develop, you might not immediately connect it with Alzheimer's. Are there other ways somebody could die?
Well, you do lose the ability to swallow
yeah.
in the latter stages. And so, you know, at some point you have to make choices about feeding tubes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's something that has to be yeah. a choice made about yeah. that. Sometimes the heart muscle, of course, will begin to have a problem. And so you may see someone have a stroke or have a heart attack, but also has Alzheimer's. And so those may be ancillary issues that come
yeah.
up that someone dies with Alzheimer's. And so when we talk about how many people who die with Alzheimer's, a lot of that, we get those records from death certificates, and that depends on how a death certificate is coded. And so someone may say they died from pneumonia with Alzheimer's, or they died from Alzheimer's, or just they died from pneumonia.
It's hard to tell.
It depends on how state codes something.
Sure.
And another thing we talked about was, you know, we have 5.3 million people who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's. One point I really want to make is that right now we know in the United States, we know this from medical professionals,
mm-hmm.
only 45% of the people who have Alzheimer's are told that by their doctors. Only 45%, less than half the people who have it are told that by their doctors. And I'm not throwing doctors under the bus. This is probably much like, I don't know, 40 years ago with cancer. Because there is no cure, a lot of times it's like, do we want to put someone through that? Do we want to tell them that? Do we have answers for them? That's part of why it's so important for us to get funding from insurance companies that allows doctors to do care planning with them, because that could make a difference for someone's outlook than to when they're given a fatal disease. And the more work that we can do in research, then that will help. Deaths from heart disease, from stroke, from HIV, AIDS, all of those have gone down. From even breast cancer and prostate cancer have gone down in the last few years. Deaths from Alzheimer's have increased 66% since the year 2000. That is directly affected, I believe, by the amount of research that we're able to do. If we can put more funding into research, we can have more answers.
Yeah. You know, this also raises the question that we often have when we change the way we study something or become more detailed in the way we study something. Are we just getting better at diagnosing it, or are there really more people that have it? But there's also, there's another factor. It's just we have a lot more people in the United States that are aging into this group at this point. So what are the special concerns that, say, somebody who's listening right now in the healthcare industry, that just have this coming wave, perhaps, of Alzheimer's that is already kind of cresting and breaking on the shore here, as baby boomers continue to age in Tennessee and throughout the nation, what is this going to look like for the medical care folks?
That's a really good question. Like Angela said, we're advocating, obviously, for more research to be done, but to have it to where doctors do make that diagnosis of Alzheimer's, and we're advocating for more dollars to have time for someone to come in and do care planning. Obviously, through research, we would love to find a medicine to either cure it or slow the progression of it. But I think the importance right now is the way the medical field would change was to put more money into people coming in and doing care planning and having doctors actually give those diagnoses.
Right. And right now, 1 in 9 people age 65 have Alzheimer's. 10,000 people a day in the United States turn 65. I'm a product of the Alabama school system. I can't do the math real quickly.
I am too, actually.
You're probably better at it than me, though. I don't know. But I can do that math real quickly. But 10,000 people a day turn 65. 1 in 9 age 65 have Alzheimer's in the U.S. It's going to be the defining disease of this generation. We've got to get a better handle on it. So care planning right now is what we can do. I do agree that as we become better at diagnosing it, that's one reason those numbers are growing, although we're still only diagnosing 45% of the people. But we have to find the answer. We have to do better at research.
I'll get personal for just a moment here. My mother's father's mother died from Alzheimer's in the mid-90s. And now my grandfather is showing some signs of impairment. We're not, of course, medical professionals in the family, so we don't know what's going on. But my mother suspects that they're not telling us everything that might be on their minds. Let's put you in her shoes. What are the questions that we need to be asking his doctor?
Wow. And how old is he?
He just turned 72.
Okay, so he's in a high-risk group to begin with. Does he smoke?
No.
Okay, so some of the things that will put him in a higher risk group is if he has untreated vascular illness. So if he has untreated high blood pressure, if he has untreated diabetes, if he has untreated heart disease, if he's ever had a stroke, those things limit blood flow to the brain already. So if he's ever had any of those or has untreated, if you have high blood pressure or diabetes and it's controlled, you're pretty much back to even. But if you have uncontrolled any of those things, you're increasing your risk. If you have midlife obesity, that's increasing your risk.
Traumatic brain injury.
If you've ever had a traumatic brain injury, that will increase your risk 5 times. I had a traumatic brain injury 8 years ago that was a pretty significant brain injury. I had to relearn some fine motor skills and speech skills, and that puts me at a much higher risk. So those things will increase his risk. So if he's ever had those things, just right off the bat, you know his risk is increased. But I would talk to the doctor and say, could you give him a mild cognitive impairment exam? That's a series of questions that they're going to ask. And part of it will include things like drawing a clock, drawing the hands on a clock. It sounds very simple, but that's very difficult for someone with mild cognitive impairment. Mm-hmm. It's a very telltale thing to do. Count backward from 100 by threes. That's difficult for anyone to do, but you can do it if you concentrate.
Sure.
It's very difficult for someone with mild cognitive impairment. There's actually a phone app that we have that's free for anyone on a smartphone. It's called Alzheimer's Disease Pocket Card. Anyone can download it. It has the mild cognitive impairment test on there that you can go on and just kind of test it and see what a doctor would ask someone. And then you get a score, and the score would then tell you whether the doctor would send someone on for an MRI. But that's free for anyone to do. But those kinds of things, just to count backward, draw things, they would give them 3 words, 3 basic words, or someone's name and address, and then have a conversation in 5 minutes, go back and say, could you tell me that man's name and address, what street he lives on?
Right.
That would be the kinds of things.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's talk about risk factors. This is something that's really interesting to me. And Sunny, we can turn to you for this because with some diseases, doctors have a pretty good idea of how to reduce one's risk factor. Like if I want to reduce my risk of lung cancer, I won't smoke.
Right.
If I want to reduce my risk of diabetes, I'll watch my weight, my diet, my exercise. But is there a way to reduce risk for Alzheimer's?
Yes, there is a way to reduce your risk. The one top way that they have come out with research is they said that actually our researchers say that exercise will decrease your risk of having Alzheimer's. So let's say we were talking about that protein buildup in our brain.
Right.
We all have it. The reason we have Alzheimer's is because it's a larger buildup of the protein. By exercising, you can actually bring that buildup down, that protein level down. So as they say, with most things, exercise is the key. So we definitely encourage doing that.
And to go back to our car engine metaphor, it's like getting regular maintenance to reduce the buildup.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Also, you are at risk. Angela touched briefly on it. If you have any type of heart, diabetes, if you go untreated for that. So let's say I had diabetes and I never took any medication, I would be at a greater risk for Alzheimer's. If you know that, you can definitely get on the medication. That would also help in prevention of Alzheimer's as well. Also, we came out with a study, I think it was last spring, that vitamin E helps slow the progression and symptoms of Alzheimer's. Mm. Now, this doesn't mean on your way home, stopping at the pharmacy and doubling up on your vitamin E.
Right.
Definitely want to ask your doctor about that, but taking vitamin E can definitely help with lowering risk.
What about genetic factors? Is there a family? Like I said, in my own family, we have Alzheimer's that has affected several members of the family. Is there a genetic link?
Yes, there is. You are at a greater risk. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that my mother has it, I'm going to have it.
Right.
You're just at a greater risk, and it's from a direct link. So your mother, father, brother, sister, if your grandmother had it, you're at a less likely risk.
Mm-hmm.
If both of your parents had it or two family members had it, you are at more of a risk for developing Alzheimer's.
But part of what you have to look at there also is what were the other contributing factors? So if you had a father or mother that had it who also had uncontrolled diabetes, was that really the greater risk? And so do you have diabetes also? So you have to look at all the factors combined. Did they have heart disease, and do you have that also? Because that will increase your risk overall. The only truly genetic that's the greatest tie genetic is the early onset, because the early onset does have a really strong genetic tie, and someone who has the early onset Alzheimer's has a genetic marker that they're 50% likely to pass on to their children.
I want to remind everybody, if you have a question for our panelists on Alzheimer's disease or its effects, you can give us a call at 974-5050. You're listening to Dialogue. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and that is our subject for those of you who are just joining us. And here's something fascinating that I learned during my research in preparation for the program. Among people who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's, sometimes the illness can develop within the brain, those changes taking place within the brain, over the course of about 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So walk me through how that develops. You know, this is a 20-year process. At what point, I guess what I'm asking here is, what do we need to know about this 20-year cycle? What does it look like for the person who's going through it?
Right. So one of the things that's happening is because this is such a, while the disease has been around for, it's been named and we've known about it for over 100 years, we've not really studied it for that long. We've studied it since about 1980. Mm. So we don't have lots of research for a long, long, long time, but we do know now that we have enough research. We've identified it in some people up to 20 years before they've shown symptoms. So we've seen it in biomarkers, we've seen it in their brain, we've seen it in PET scans, we've seen it, and then we know that it's beginning to happen before they even begin to show symptoms, which is exciting to know that we can see it that far ahead of time, but it begs the question then, so what is going on with them? And for many of them, nothing different has changed. We just see that in their brain, and we can watch them and see, do they make lifestyle changes? Does it affect them? And that's why we know that some of these lifestyle changes can help. So eating a Mediterranean diet can help affect affect whether you, it can prolong whether the Alzheimer's then manifests itself or not. So there are some changes you can make, but it's just kind of there lying dormant before you actually begin to show those signs and symptoms. So let's say two people, equal age, everything else equal about them, but we know that you both have it. We can see it on PET scans, but one person's eating a Mediterranean diet and doing some exercise. Well, the other person may begin to show symptoms at age 66 or 67. The other person may not show symptoms until 74, 75. So it really can make a difference until it begins to show. And when it begins to show, what I'm talking about is that you have impairment to the point that you can't drive any longer, that you can't find your way around the grocery store, that you can't continue in social activities, that you can't follow in conversations, that you can no longer do those things.
I want to spend basically the balance of the program. We do have a break coming up shortly, but the balance of the program talking about what life looks like for people with Alzheimer's, what it looks like for their families mm-hmm. and their friends, the people who are going to be affected by this, who aren't diagnosed with the disease but will be touched by it in some way. For people who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's, that's got to be a psychological shock, I would imagine.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Just incredible for them. And Sunny, you just, probably talk to more folks.
Yeah. When they're first diagnosed, the first thing they probably go through and have gone through is denial. They don't want anybody to know. You know, you're sitting there and you receive this information at a doctor's office, you're at your appointment. I would probably shut down and walk out and then think of about 100 questions I should have asked. That's what a lot of – we get calls about that. That's why we get the calls usually with those questions. But, yes, a lot of the – one of the first signs is depression, and that's usually people, like Angela touched on a little bit, become more reclusive, and they don't want to be caught forgetting someone's name or not remembering someone's birthday, and they just don't want to be out in a social situation where they can't remember something. So the first couple of stages is depression and denial and not really wanting people to know. That goes back to not, you know, people kind of saying shying away from the term Alzheimer's.
Let's pause right now for that break. Like I said, we're going to spend the rest of the show talking about that side of the disease. Right now, though, we are going to pause for a station break, and this is Dialogue from WUOT News. Brandon Hollingsworth back with you at about 20 minutes before the hour of 2 o'clock on this Wednesday afternoon, the 7th day of October, and this is Dialogue from WUOT News. If you're just joining us, our subject, Alzheimer's in Tennessee. We're talking about this disease, the sixth leading cause of death for Americans 65 and older, a disease that affects 110,000 Tennesseans, and those are just the cases we know about. The number could be higher. Our guests from the Alzheimer's Association today are Sunny Biden and Angela Jones, and right before the break, we got into what this is like, this new phase of life for people, and it doesn't have anything to do with intelligence or how many crossword puzzles you do or whatever. You can be affected by this disease. It can get you, and in that sense, it could radically or will radically change your life. So as we talk about this, what are the treatments that exist? We know there's no cure. We talked about that earlier. There's no shot. There's no pill that makes it go away. What are the available treatment options?
There are six medications that are that we do recommend that you can take. Depending on which stage you are, that's what the medication will be. Like I said earlier, the medications are to slow the symptoms, and make them less severe. Someone who may become more depressed, you might take a medication for depression. We also encourage taking more higher doses of vitamin E. Like I said, that's pretty much all you can do, but hopefully research will bring something more about for that.
Well, as part of this big change to the person's life, I would imagine they would have to start preparing for things they've never had to prepare for before, and that might mean updating a will. It might mean trying to find a caregiver for later stages. What are going to be some of those conversations that I would need, if I'm diagnosed with Alzheimer's, what do I need to plan for now while I still can, that sort of thing?
Right. You definitely want to plan financially, setting up a will and getting your financial plans in order, as well as a care plan, meaning do you want to stay at home and your family is going to take care of you, or are you going to move to an assisted living? You know, there are options out there for people who do live at home to have respite care, to have people come in and work with them, as well as there's adult day programs that they can also attend.
And those, I imagine, are most effective for like the early stages. For later stages, that's going to require a lot of care. That's going to require some important steps to be taken, right?
Right. You can, therefore, you know, you can decide with your family members if someone is going to take care of you from your family, or we encourage definitely looking into memory units around town, because they're set to handle you at your stage.
You know, one of the things that we really encourage folks to think about when they start thinking about the latter stages, while everybody always wants family members to stay home, you have to think about a safety issue, and not just for the person with Alzheimer's, but for the rest of the family.
Right.
We've actually heard a story, and this never occurred to me until someone told us this story, that the person with Alzheimer's, because they didn't know their family member, came after them with a knife from the kitchen to hurt them.
Mm.
So it's unsafe sometimes for the family member, not just, oh, the person with the disease may fall, but it can be really unsafe because if they don't recognize you and know you any longer, it can be unsafe.
And there's also some fascinating statistics in an annual report the Alzheimer's Association put together that sort of outlined the prevalence of the disease. And I was reading through this, and when it comes to the part about caregivers, there's a lot of responsibility that does typically fall on family members. But the numbers are interesting. In a survey, more than half of caregivers, family caregivers, said that because they were having to take care of a family member with Alzheimer's, they had to miss work, take time off, come in late, leave early. More than 10%, more than 1 in 10, said they had to switch from full-time jobs back to part-time in order to absorb this responsibility. 1 in 10 said they had to give up working entirely to take care of a family member with Alzheimer's. This is a tremendous responsibility for family members. So I guess one of the questions needs to be, is that what you're prepared to do?
Right.
It's not just going to be sort of picking up around the house and reminding them where they put their keys. There's a lot that goes into taking
care. It's a lifestyle change.
Yeah,
the economic impact of Alzheimer's is staggering, not just the literal cost of the medical costs, the Medicare dollars, those things, but the cost to caregivers of the change in lifestyle is amazing and staggering to them. And a lot of times people aren't prepared to think that all the way through. And because, you know, you have a surface conversation when someone is first diagnosed and you think you have figured it out. But then once you get further down the road, you think, well, I promised I would do ABC, but now ABC may not be very realistic.
Right.
And so we really encourage you to think through all the scenarios and be really hesitant to promise ABC because it's an unknown land you're going to. You just don't know where you're headed.
And with that decision comes a lot. If you choose to stay at home and at a later stage, there's so much stress involved usually on the caregiver. So we really encourage them to think long and hard before staying at home.
Well, what about other options that would be like a nursing facility, a care facility, or a hospice or something? At what point should that enter into the discussions? Is that something that could be done early on?
I actually encourage it to be done early on because that way, example, for early onset, you are still aware of everything, newly diagnosed. You can actually probably go and look to see where you'd want to be, who would take care of you the best.
Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine, because this is all a lot of information, people might be driving around right now or they're at their desks. Where can I go online to find out more information, maybe some resources for this kind of planning, and just to do my homework on this?
You can definitely go to our website, www.alz.org.
Mm-hmm.
/TN is our Tennessee page, but alz.org will definitely gives you a plethora of information.
Okay.
And another important resource, if you're driving, don't stop to do this. You can find it on the website, is our 1-800 number, which is 800-272-3900. That number is answered 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every single day of the year by social workers who can help you plan doctor's visits, who can help you at 3 a.m. when you've got someone up who's wandering and won't go back to bed, and you just need to say, how can I get them back in bed? I don't know what to do. You know, the holidays are coming up. People are going to go home, visit their parents, grandparents. They're going to leave, and some folks are going to be concerned by something they saw, and you just want to call someone and say, I'm seeing this. Is that normal or something I should be concerned about? Call the 1-800 number. Talk to them. It's also a way you can get to our local office. There's an option on there. You can get to us here in Knoxville. But the 1-800 number is answered every single day by wonderful people who can help you figure out what you're seeing, if it's something to be concerned about or not.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the special challenges that might be faced by Alzheimer's patients here in Tennessee, where we have wide swaths of rural territory where you're not going to be near a state-of-the-art care facility in an urban center. What are the options for people who do live in rural areas or areas that are not as well served by medical care industry?
Well, see, I wish I had an answer for that.
Yeah.
And there aren't great answers. You know, every county in Tennessee is served by an area office on aging.
Yes.
And so the area office on agings will have the best answer for what your services are. Our 1-800 number has those numbers for every county
the
state.
Yeah.
So you can call our 1-800 number or go online and find that also. But they will have a list of what in-home services are available. Because I'll be honest, in Knox County, I don't know what's available in Overton County. You know, but so anyone out there listening, you can have that available. And the 1-800 number has it for every county in the country. And so if you're in Knox County and you wonder what it is for a county in Nebraska where you've got family, they can help you with that. So there is an area office on aging that will know what in-home services are available, what social activities are out there, where there's an office, where there's a like a day center for folks. But you're right, the rural settings, it's much, much harder. That's, you know, they don't have as much access to health care as quickly. They don't have as much access to physicians. There aren't as many diagnostic centers. That creates more of a challenge, definitely. And so a lot of times what we see folks getting more involved is their churches, because that can be a social outlet. We try to do a lot more outreach with churches to educate them, to help them know how to maintain activities for older members, for older people in the community, whether they're members or not, just to keep them involved in something.
There's also senior centers around town, too, where they can go and get information about their loved one, and there's activities for them to stay social. And they all have health fairs, I think, too, there as well at those senior centers across town.
So a lot of it might be, if you're listening to us right now in a rural county away from Crossville, Knoxville, Chattanooga, or the Tri-Cities, to just check with local county agencies, whatever's around the area, Agency on Aging, I hope I got that right.
Yes.
And find out what resources are available from there. So maybe resources that you're not aware of. Sonny, I understand you do talking with people who are dealing with Alzheimer's and the family members. I want to ask you about maybe misconceptions. We talked about some of those mental speed bumps. Like, I don't want to admit that my grandfather might have this, or I don't want to think about the possibility this might happen. What do you encounter most commonly from people who are reticent about dealing with this issue, and how do you talk to them about that?
The question I get the most is, how do I get them to go to the doctor? I'm recognizing signs that my family member or loved one is forgetting things. And I think we just encourage them to go with them and to keep a journal before their doctor's visits, pointing out different times where they have forgotten things. We also try to tell people that, you know, this person isn't forgetting things to get on your nerves or to make you lose your patience. This is a disease.
Right.
This disease is affecting this person and changing their behavior. So we try to encourage them to kind of just look at this as a disease and not this person who is forgetting things and repeating things over and over again to just make you lose your patience.
Right. Well, it also has to do with something we've talked about a couple of times this hour, which is kind of staying after the doctor a little bit to ask, and not just sort of walk out and, okay, thanks, we'll see you next time, but to ask questions, to, if something is on your mind and you don't feel like you got the right answer, you don't feel like you're getting the whole story, to ask more questions about that. Are there resources on the Alzheimer's website about maybe questions to take to your physician?
Yes, there. I actually pulled it up today when I was looking up something on the website. There is a PDF you can download of the most common questions to ask your doctor. And Angela pointed out earlier that our helpline can help you prepare for a doctor's visit. So if you the person with Alzheimer's wants to call the helpline, or your family member wants to call and say, how do we prep for this? What medications do we be on?
Right.
What type of questions should we be asking?
Right, because very few of us are qualified to know how to deal with
this.
Even as common as it is, very few of us are, I think, prepared from the outset to do that. So we probably need all the help we can get on homework and stuff like that to learn about it. We talked a little bit earlier about early onset Alzheimer's and that it has some significant differences to a more traditional form of Alzheimer's that develops later. And that opens up a new realm of questioning about what we don't know about Alzheimer's. A lot of the research, I'm sure, is still in its infancy and is going on. What are some of the big questions? I want to ask both of you, but we'll start with you, Angela. What are some of the big questions on your mind? But boy, I wish I had an answer for why Alzheimer's does this or behaves this way. What do you want to know about it that we don't already know?
I want to know why 2/3 of all the people with Alzheimer's are women. That's something we've know now after some long-term studies that 2/3 of all people with Alzheimer's are women. We know that something about those two proteins binds with the estrogen in a woman's body that makes us more likely to have Alzheimer's, that makes us decline at a more rapid rate. And as a woman, I want to know why.
Yeah.
We don't know that answer yet. We've not done it long-term enough yet to know exactly, is it because you have higher estrogen levels? You know, is that affected? We just know estrogen affects it. So as a woman, I want to know what that's about. And that's forefront for me.
Well, something I wanted to know, Sunny, we'll get to you in just a second, but it raised the question in my mind when Sunny was talking about reducing risk factors, like exercise can help sort of wash away those proteins before they build up. Why don't we have something that can just make the proteins go away? You know, I mean, like, where there are treatments that can help slow the effects of Alzheimer's, why can't we take that further to stop it or arrest it in some way? That's a big question I'm sure that people are looking into throughout medicine.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
So with the exercise, what happens is the endorphins that are released help stop the buildup of those proteins. They don't bind to your brain as well. Once they're in your brain, though, there's not a brain surgery that can, scrape it clean.
Right.
But don't we wish we had that?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, Sunny, what do you want to know about Alzheimer's that hasn't yet been answered?
My question kind of goes along with yours, is I want to know why early onset Alzheimer's exists, why people 65, below 65, early 60s develop Alzheimer's, because it's so different than we've had a long time for this protein to build up on our brains, so that obviously makes sense for why you get it when you're older. But what caused that buildup so soon to happen? And once you get early onset Alzheimer's, it progresses so fast.
Yeah, why is it so aggressive?
I think my questions stem, and what could you be doing, to tag on to yours, what could you be doing to really prevent the early onset? Because, I exercise almost every day, and I would think to myself, Alzheimer's, I wouldn't want it at 60. What could I be doing differently to prevent that?
Earlier in the hour, I believe it was you, Angela, mentioned that up to 45% of doctors, is it only 45% of doctors tell their patients?
Only 45% of people with Alzheimer's know it.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Yeah. So roughly 4 out of 10, a little more than 4 out of 10 have been actually told. The other ones, not quite. 6 out of 10 may not know they have it. What are the conversations that the two of you have with medical care professionals in the community about maybe raising this to the forefront? Maybe if somebody in your office and you think they might have Alzheimer's, but they're not asking, why don't you go ahead and start the conversation? I mean, do you ever talk to doctors about that?
We have some. I've talked with my personal physician about it, and she is a proponent of telling people. Mm-hmm. We've also had conversations about some of her colleagues and why they may not. And she says, I think it's because there's just a discomfort about, I'm giving you a death sentence. When I was in medical school, if you were going into oncology, they spent all this time about how to tell someone they have cancer. If you were going into, cardiology, they spent all this time telling someone they have heart disease. They spent a day and a half talking about Alzheimer's, and they never told us how to tell someone you have a death sentence from Alzheimer's.
Wow.
So we don't know how to do that, and people don't know how to accept that. So that is something that the Alzheimer's Association, that's our burden, is that we need to teach doctors how to talk about it and how to talk to families about there is support out there, there are options for care out there, there is a support system. While there is not a cure, there is a support system. And we have a lot of clinical trials out there that people can enroll in that perhaps can help them as they go through this journey right now. So doctors, I think, are reluctant because there are no answers, and it's just not something they were taught to do. And people are generally going to their primary care physicians, and that's not something primary care physicians generally do, is give a death sentence. They don't give that kind of news. Yeah. That's usually a different kind of doctor.
Yeah.
And we have met with different medical centers to talk about because they feel that way and because of timing and insurance, we say put us at the forefront. We mm-hmm. put provider information in your office, direct them. If they don't want to take the time to do care planning, here's who you call. So that's kind of our focus, is just trying to get them to point to us if they can't do that at that time.
Also, I would imagine conversations with lawmakers, and this might be more on the national level, but talking about funding for the research and stuff like this, and to get to lawmakers to understand that this is a public health issue as well,
oh, yes.
that it's not just an individual family here, family there. We're talking about 5.3 million Americans
right.
with a number that's only expected to get larger.
Right.
So what are those conversations like for you, or is that something that you guys are involved
in? We do that on a national level mm-hmm. each year in the spring. We have our advocacy forum in Washington, D.C. We had about 1,000 people this last year. We'll have more than that, I'm sure, this year in March, I believe, in D.C., where we meet with every congressional member. We have volunteers who meet with them and talk about their personal stories and why we want more funding for Alzheimer's research. Right now, we have about $480 million that's allocated from Congress for research. We're asking for an additional $325 million. That's what the National Institutes of Health say that they need. So that is a big conversation. And Congress actually has been pretty responsive when we've asked for those increases. Now, that's a pretty big jump that we're asking for this mm-hmm. next year. But as they have seen some of their colleagues age and have Alzheimer's, they have been more responsive to us than some of the other diseases that have asked for increases in funding. So we'd love to come back and talk about that with some of our volunteers who are advocates mm-hmm. who attend the forum, if you'd like to know more about that, because that's a fascinating time when we're in D.C. and asking for that, just the give
sure,
and take with that.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. And one last time before we go, I do want to give the website is alz.org/TN mm-hmm. for Tennessee Resources, and there's lots of stuff on there. There is the 800 number, somebody, Sonny?
It's 1-800-272-3900.
3900. And there is also, which I love this, Angela, there's an app. There's always an app
yes.
these
yes,
days.
There's an app.
It's a
now.
Free app.
It's a free app, and you can check, I guess, an app store for whatever device
right.
you may have.
The Alzheimer's Disease Pocket Card. And the logo for it's a little white brain, and it says ALZ.
Okay. All right. Well, see, I love that this is great. This is one of those things that talking about how medicine advances, yeah, in the laboratory in one way, but also public outreach changes
right.
in another. We can get
yes.
somebody's phone and have it right there. So thank you so much, Angela Jones and Sonny Biden, both from the Alzheimer's Association here based in Knoxville. Thank you both for coming in, and I'd love to have you guys back after your visit to Washington, and we can talk about that maybe in 2016.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, indeed. In the meantime, you've been listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. Greg Hill is our producer and answered the phones. Thanks to everybody who contributed to today's show. And we will see you again first Wednesday in November. Hope you'll be there too. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Stay tuned for Afternoon Concert with Whitney Dodds at 2 o'clock Eastern Time, 91.9 FM WUOT and WUOT HD1 Knoxville, online at WUOT.org.